Louise Steinman, curator of Aloud, a series of dynamic lectures, readings, performances, and discussion that take place in the Mark Taper Auditorium in the historic Downtown Central Library in the heart of Los Angeles. You're about to hear actors Alan Alda and Mike Farrell in a conversation titled Two Actors, Two Authors, Two Lives. This program was originally presented on September 18, 2007. For more information on Aloud, please go to our website, www.aloudla.org. Please welcome Alan Alda and Mike Farrell.
Mike and I were backstage for the last few minutes just catching up on each other's lives, and we didn't spend any time figuring out how we were going to talk tonight, which I'm glad we didn't, because I think it should be spontaneous. What do you think?
Well, you're always pushy. He always wants to direct.
You know, Mike wrote this really, really good book called Just Call Me Mike, which is lengthy, too. It's 300 and some pages, and it doesn't have an index, which I didn't like, because it was very hard to find myself in the book. I swear to God, I nearly had to read the whole thing.
He mentions a friend of his named Mike in one of his books, and it's not me.
Oh, that's right. I forgot that. Yeah, well, that was a Mike I knew before I met you.
Yeah.
Yeah, that was, yeah. Yeah, but I did mention you with your big feet and your cheesy mustache.
Oh, that was in that other book.
Hey, what happened to the mustache?
Here. The mustache was his idea.
No, it wasn't.
It was. You called me and you said, I've got an idea for BJ. What do you think about this?
This is crazy. I never said anything like
you
that.
You did.
What? Are you
on
kidding?
On my very telephone, and I have a recording of it. Well, I don't, but the government does.
I was going to. But what?
The government does.
Oh, that's funny. That's good. That's good, yeah. No, that's, but you're kidding, right?
No, I'm not kidding.
I suggested the mustache.
Suggested the mustache.
I hated that mustache.
Which is why you suggested it for me.
You know, we were just waiting to come on. And I said to Mike, this is like when we were standing outside the door waiting to go into the operating room in MASH. And I said, or that other room, what did you call it? The one where the sick guys get better.
And I said, the post op. He said, oh, yeah, the post op.
It was so long ago.
This is just, yeah. This is just after we were having a conversation in the room, and he said, do you think much about MASH? And I said, oh, I think about it all the time. And he said, you know, I don't. He said, I remember it in great detail, but I just don't think about it much. And then he couldn't remember the post op.
I couldn't remember what that room was. Well, we used to sit and play chess all the time. I asked Mike if he was still playing chess, because in between scenes, in between shots, we had a chess board. And I do remember very clearly that this soundstage we worked on was not very well kept. It was the smallest soundstage on the lot at 20th Century Fox, and it had no air conditioning, and it was really hot, and at night the mice would come in and pee on our chessboard. And I really felt that we were in Korea for 11 years.
Gary complained about it. Only Gary called them rats.
He called them rats.
Yes, yes. Now, Alan's leaving out the fact that we played Scrabble.
Yeah.
We had push-up contests.
Yeah, well, that didn't last very long. And we used to try to see if we could learn how to stand on our hands.
Yes, right.
I could stand on my head, but I couldn't stand on my hands.
Yeah. And we played a game, do you remember the game that it was a word game that we would play, you don't write it down, but you have to think of a word and then have the other guy think of what the word is and do it through a process
of elimination.
I can't
even understand what you're saying. Don't I remember it, I can't understand you right now. What kind of game is this?
Because I'm typically unintelligible.
Yeah. No, yeah. So I don't remember. Did it have a name, this game?
No, we made it up.
I remember we used to play Name That Tap. So this is, I mean, you know, after you're on the set for about 15 hours, you really start to get a little dippy. And so we'd sit there kind of semi-groggy, and we'd tap our combat boots on the floor, and you'd tap out a song. But it didn't have any melody, just taps, you know. What's that? Oh, come on. Give my regards to Broadway.
It's the same one you did 30 years ago, and I didn't remember it then.
I remember playing Name That Tap. Jamie Farr used to be very good at Name That Tap.
Was he?
Yeah. I think your feet were too big for it.
It's a possibility. It was very slow when I was tapping.
He used to walk behind me. That's the other game that he alone would play.
That's right.
He would walk behind me when they called us to the, look, I'm getting all choked up about this. When we would walk to the set, when the set was lit, I'd get up and I'd walk over, and he'd be right behind me, stepping on my heels to see if he could make me fall down.
The falling down was your problem.
Mike actually is a very macho, athletic guy. He was, what were you, in the military police? Do I have that right?
No.
Well, maybe that was me. Wait a minute.
I was a Marine.
Yeah, and didn't you like arrest people and learn judo and all that?
Oh no, that was after I got out of the Marines. I was a martial artist and a private investigator.
Yeah, you were in
but
the military.
I didn't arrest
police.
Anybody. You can't.
You used to go into bars and drag people out.
That was when I was a bouncer.
Well, you told me a whole other story.
He remembers everything in great detail. It's just some other Mike.
Yeah, that other Mike, I really like him. He was great.
Yeah, I learned a lot from this man. I remember talking one day on the set, and I said, you know, people, Alan just talked about the 15 hours and the grind and the stuff, and I said, you know, some people think that this acting stuff is a snap. They don't realize that there's a lot of tension involved, there are a lot of hours involved, there's a lot of, it's hard work. And Alan said, it's not like digging ditches. Something that has stuck with me through the years.
Well, I was told once by an old actor that he knew the guy who played the original Hopalong Cassidy in silent movies, whose name I forget. And he was sitting there with his leading lady, and out in the desert on location. And he said, look at us actors. We get up at 4 in the morning. It's freezing cold. We come out to the desert. We work in the hot sun all day. We get blisters and red-faced. And what do we get out of it? Nothing but a damn fortune. Only he didn't say damn. I know this is going out by podcast. You know?
Oh, yes, right. I have to tell you, Alan, I actually did tell you in the other room, but I'll tell you again. I laughed so hard in your new book. By the way, I resent the fact that you've now written two books. I thought one was plenty. I thought I could do, you know, you're right, I overwrote a bit. My book is a bit longer than yours. But I thought, you know, okay, he wrote a book, I wrote a book. Now he comes out with a second. What was the word that wasn't in the story you just
index.
Told?
Index.
No, the word that wasn't in the story you just told.
What word wasn't in the
story? The adjective that wasn't in the story you just told.
Oh, yes. Oh, right, right.
Imagine that word, a second
book.
But in it, I must tell you, for those of you who haven't yet read it, and I insist that you all do, there's a wonderful story about Alan taking his daughter Elizabeth to on a trip on the Orient Express. It is a fabulous, laugh out loud, wonderful, wonderful story, and I admire you for not taking me. No, actually, I'm a little envious. He never took me anywhere.
No. Well, I want to know a little bit about what you talk about in your book. I was very interested in if you don't mind telling about it, what was that? The most amazing thing for me in your book was that after all those years of pretending to operate on people.
Yeah.
You actually assisted at an operation. Mm. How? What? Would you tell a little about that?
Sure. A little complicated. I was involved in the issue pertinent to U.S. involvement in Central America in the 80s, particularly in El Salvador. For those of you who don't know, there was a war in El Salvador, a civil war. People who were the impoverished, the peasants, the people in the mountains who were fighting against this very oppressive government were considered to be communists, although they were not. At least most of them weren't. And the tensions inside the country were extraordinary. They were very, very, very volatile. And I'd been in the country a number of times with human rights organizations to try to see to it that things were calmed down, to see if we could find a way toward peace. And one of the comandantes of the guerrilla forces was captured, wounded and captured. And we got word that she was being held in prison, and she had been wounded in her arm, and that she was losing the use of her hand. And the question then became, under international humanitarian law and the laws of war, if somebody deserves and needs medical attention, you get it. But in El Salvador, the tensions were such that she was considered untouchable, and they would not provide the medical attention needed. So we put on an international campaign, actually, to get El Salvadoran government to provide this medical care for her. And finally, they agreed to allow the surgery to take place, but would not do it. No Salvadoran medical person would take part in this surgery. So we got an American doctor, a doctor from the United States, and his wife, a nurse anesthetist, to agree to go down. And Amnesty International asked me to go as an observer, which I had agreed to do. I was part of the campaign that got the doctor to go. And on the way down there, Dr. S, I will refer to him as, continued to show me photos of the surgery that he thought would had to be done in order to repair this woman's hand. And I thought it was interesting that he was showing me these. And he said, well, you were on MASH, you know, and you know about surgery. And I said, yeah, but, yeah, okay, sure, thanks, Doc. And we got down there. We were not warmly welcomed by the government because they weren't happy that we were there, and they weren't happy that the surgery was going to take place. We went in and visited the woman in the prison, and she was quite extraordinary. He examined her, and then he introduced me, and he had me look at the wound. I thought, what is this? And then we left, and we were told we would be called later. And in fact, sometime after midnight, we were called out, and we were led out to an armored car, and armored jeep, actually. And then we were preceded and followed by heavily armed vehicles with soldiers bristling with weapons, because there was some fear, I suppose, that either somebody would try to kill us or somebody would try to spring her if they knew where she was. And they took us to a medical facility and went in the back door and came upstairs. And the doctor and his wife, the nurse anesthetist, and I walked into this room. And there were three Salvadoran medical technicians there, no doctors. And the minute we walked in, and she was laid out on a gurney and with the necessary utensils around. And the minute we walked in the room, they all left. And I didn't think much of it. And the doctor said, went over and checked the patient, and his wife, the nurse anesthetist, started setting up the anesthesia. And then he turned to me and he said, put on a gown and gloves. And I said, I'm sorry? And he said, I need you to assist me. I thought I was going to have another doctor here to assist, and I need your hands. And I said, Doc, you got to be kidding. I'm an actor. he said, well, you've done it many times on television. I said, that was fake. There were sponges and fake blood, and we never really cut anybody. I can't stand the sight of blood. I'm not. And he said, and we had a long discussion, but and he finally said, either you help me or we can't do this surgery. And I said, what? This is insane. And he said, it's you help me or we go home. And she is not going to be have her hand repaired. And I said, well, first you have to tell the patient that you're asking somebody who has no idea what he's doing to be part of this procedure. And he said, he went over to her and he spoke Spanish and he spoke to her and she laughed and said, and it was translated to me, out in the mountains, them that can do.
So he said, where did that leave you?
Right. He said, you know the surgical technique, the sterile techniques, you know the procedures. All you do is just do what I tell you. Just go in, and his wife put on a gown and my gloves and the mask, and I went out. I was terrified that I was going to either pass out or throw up. And I said, okay, let's go. And he made the first incision, and it was like going into another world. It was just extraordinary when I didn't pass out or throw up. And suddenly he said, retract here and do this. And he said, you just mirror my actions. And suddenly we were in this whole other universe. And it was just the most amazing experience. And ultimately, I was working with him and I was boring holes and I actually cut one of the finger tendons and translated it and he tied it onto the thumb. And
how did you find out what translating meant? What's that?
Did I say use the wrong word?
No, what is it?
No,
what
I just meant it would translate when anything that had to be said. No, I meant he
cut. Oh, translating the language.
Yes, indeed. I should have said transferred. Did you know that we have two tendons hooked to our index finger?
Yeah.
And that if you cut one of them, this index finger will still work. Mm-hmm. So we cut one of them, and then I moved it over, and we attached it to the thumb so that she could then control her thumb. And I said, now, isn't she, next time she wants to point at something, going to be pointing with her thumb too? And he said, for a while, but the brain will... the brain will reteach, and soon the wonderful for me finale to the story is that not only was the surgery a success, but seven years later, there was a truce signed, a peace treaty signed in El Salvador, and Nydia Diaz used that hand to sign that peace treaty.
It's an amazing experience you had. I think I would have probably gotten sick. I didn't want to ever look at a real operation the whole time we were doing MASH. And then after the show was over, a couple of years later, I started doing the science program, Scientific American Frontiers, and then I had to watch up close really awful operations.
Really?
That was part of it. I once watched while a woman had a brain operation, and they had sliced off the top part of her skull, and I'm standing there with the doctor looking into her head, and the woman is awake all during the operation.
Oh, really?
So she can tell him, when he pokes in her brain, he says, where do you feel that? And she says, that's my toe. He says, okay, what about this? Oh, that's my knee. And she's guiding him so he knows what not to cut out.
You know? God.
And then the producer says, now go around to the other side and interview her during the operation. As I was walking around, I said, "You will not ask her how she feels about this." But I found that people are really interested in telling you about what's happening to them when they're having an operation or they've just had one. They just want to talk about the facts.
Now, how could she be conscious and talking to you and responding to you when?
I guess they gave her some kind of an anesthetic apparently the brain, I don't know why you get headaches when you can poke somebody in the head. in the brain. You know, I mean, isn't the headache similar to that? I don't. I really don't understand why she was able to be. She was, you know, she had some kind of sedation, but she didn't feel him poking in her brain, except in the toe.
In the toe.
Yeah.
God, that's wonderful.
But the one that really got me was when they were operating on an 8-year-old girl, and I had the experience you did. I started looking around on the floor for a good place to fall down when I passed out. I was really trying to say, if I fall down, I don't want to hit my head. Right. I felt like I was going to go any minute.
Yeah.
I don't know how doctors do that.
I don't either.
I mean, they take the responsibility of people's lives in their hands.
Yep.
You know, speaking of which, I think we should explain your foot.
Oh, no.
Mike came out on crutches down there. What are you, canes? And I thought it was a lot of trouble to go to get the audience's sympathy. Did you actually hurt yourself, or
fact,
is this?
The fact is, folks, you cannot be on stage with a man who has the stage presence he does without a crutch.
Pretty good. What did you do to yourself?
I fell down a hill, is the short story. Alan immediately said, this wasn't on your motorcycle, was it?
I'm amazed he's still in one piece from that motorcycle. You had just taken how long a trip?
7,000 miles.
7,000?
It's my therapy. Some people do it different ways. For me, solitary motorcycle cross-country riding is my therapy. And
well, it's not working.
And this particular time, I wanted to go to the Arctic Circle, and did. Rode to the Arctic Circle, and riding back, I got all the way back into Northern California, stopped in the Redwoods just to stretch my legs, walked over to a place that had a very steep drop-off, but I thought I could negotiate it, and I was wrong. Down I went.
You see, that's why my book is shorter than him. He's more interesting than I am.
I never stuffed my dog.
that was the first book. My father suggested we stuff the family dog after he died, and it was a horrible experience because he came back from the taxidermist with a hideous expression on his face that it looked like he was going to leap at your throat. And people came into the living room. We had him next to the fireplace. People actually came in, stopped, and saw this thing with the glassy eyes and the ferocious look on his face, and they literally backed out of the living room. So that became the reason the book was called that, is it became an image for me of how you can't hold back death. You can't hold back any change. You have to let it go. I mean, that's what I learned. I had to let it go, and I was always looking for spontaneity. And it's interesting. Your book is about making change, and my book is more about surfing change, I think.
Surfing?
Surfing change.
That's interesting.
Letting change happen and trying to negotiate it.
Well, you've always been. It's a wonderful thing to have. I've had the great privilege of spending 8 years with this gentleman, and. You've always been so curious about everything, and totally unwilling to accept anything that didn't adhere to the scientific principle.
Oh, that may be true. Yeah.
Yeah. And what do you mean, maybe?
Well, I mean, I take everything you say with a grain of salt.
But when I heard about the scientific.
Scientific American
Scientific
Frontiers.
American.
Yeah, thank you.
I thought this is perfect for this man. His love of science, his extraordinary brain, this incredible curiosity. I couldn't think of a better match for you than that.
Well, that's kind.
No, truly,
thank you. Thank
truly.
You.
And so I wish you'd quit just acting and go back to doing that and let me have some of these bloody roles that you keep saying.
Well, Mike always impressed me with how well read he was. You always had a book on foreign policy, or healthcare, all kinds of stuff. Oh, the other thing that impressed me about him, I think you should know these things about him because he's regarded by so many people as admirable. This man not only is a vegetarian, which I find is fine. I don't consider that. Thank you. Yes, it's good for the planet. However, he would come to the set with a big bottle of green stuff, the liquid. I don't know what he made it out of, but it was green. It would pulverized vegetables, and he would slurp it all day long. And you still do that, don't you?
Yes, I do. Yeah. I don't slurp, however. I try to drink in a dainty fashion.
Yeah.
I try to be appropriate when I'm carrying my bottle of green stuff around.
Everybody, it was interesting. We were on a show in which all the characters that we played were quirky in some way. And all the actors who played them were quirky in some way. Everybody had a personality that everybody else could, like, you know, you could capsulize it in a second. We began learning before you got on the show how to negotiate our way around one another's personalities. And got pretty good at it. I don't think by the time you got there, or maybe so, I don't remember. When you came on the show, were we still sitting around in chairs at the end of the week? Trying to resolve things together?
Oh, not as a regular practice, but there were a couple of times when things were apparently unresolvable and we did sit around in chairs.
And hash things out.
Hash things out, yes.
But, you know, that I really think that it contributed a lot to why the show was successful, because we had respect for one another.
Mm-hmm.
And even though we recognized that everybody but yourself was a little nutty, that we really worked together. We found ways to work together. And the other thing that I really loved and that I learned so much from on that show was how we sat around in a circle of chairs and kidded each other, made each other laugh all day long. I remember, I don't know if, do you remember this? I remember it was so... The kidding and the laughing was so intense that there were times when we didn't keep quiet, even when they called quiet on the set. then they would do the clapper thing and they'd say, scene one, take one, and hit the thing. We still weren't quiet. We'd quiet down a little bit.
Right.
Then the director would say action, and there would still be somebody laughing. And then just before the first line, everybody would quiet down.
Right.
But we would take that that connection we had, mm-hmm, with one another, that we had off camera, and we would bring it on camera and keep it going, but with the lines of the scene. And that's, I think, one of the big reasons that everybody says, why was it so successful? Of course, it had unbelievably good writing and directing, and the talents of the actors was phenomenal. However, we had a connection with one another,
mm-hmm,
that was genuine. And it played itself out through the connection that the characters had. And I really think that contributed a lot to it. And I'd never do a play now without trying to get the other actors to do that. And every time that we've fallen into that pattern, it's been a sensational experience acting on the stage. In the play Art that I did on Broadway, and we did here at the Mark Taper. That's a wonderful theater that Gordon Davidson ran for decades and made it thank you Gordon.
Yes, thank you Gordon.
and when we did Art, Victor Garber and Alfred Molina and I would sit for an hour before each performance, eight times a week, and for that hour we would just rib each other mercilessly, and we were hilarious within minutes and for a whole hour. And we would keep it up just the way we did on MASH right before the first line of dialogue. We would do this until seconds before the curtain went up. And boom, there we were talking to the audience. And as each actor came on stage, that connection was still there from a few minutes earlier.
Yeah, that's wonderful. Now, there were times when something was so fabulously funny that we were we were sort of unable to control ourselves. And then the director, I remember Bert Metcalf, who was our executive producer and director a significant period of time toward the end of the show, would say, children, children, we we must get moving now.
Hey, you know, several of the actors also directed as time went on, and it was really funny. Everybody behaved like a child, you know, was out of control when he or she wasn't directing. But as soon as one of us was directing, then that person became the schoolmaster. You know. Now look here. We have to get this show done, you know. We're running out of light, you know. And everybody else would just keep on kidding. They didn't pay any attention. Who was it who used to say, let's not lose our breakneck pace?
Charlie Dubin.
He was great.
Oh, wonderful.
Yeah, it was a wonderful time. I'm beginning to remember it now. Which one were you?
I still have some problem with that. I got a letter one time from a person saying, you were the most extraordinary actor on the show. You were the one I loved. The show was never the same when you were not there. Would you please sign this and send it back to me? And it was a picture of Wayne Rogers. So I signed it.
What did you sign it?
Tear. No. I don't want to tell you. But one of the words was the one you couldn't say earlier. Oh.
Did anybody, this was very scary because we were playing doctors who saved people. Yeah. I would get letters from people who said they were on the verge of suicide and only I could help them. Did you ever get letters like
yes,
that?
Yes, a couple of times. Actually, we talked about a couple of them and you were very helpful because you had already had that experience when I...
Oh, right. I had gotten them early on. Yeah, well, this was a bizarre experience. It was one of the things that I talk about in the new book, how odd celebrity can be, and because that show was so popular, we became well known in a way that was beyond anything that any of us had any experience with, and when I got the first letter from someone. Who said, I think a teenager said she wanted to kill herself. I was so dumbfounded. I didn't want to say the wrong thing. I didn't want to say something that would send her over the edge. I didn't want to be, I didn't want to be condescending to her. I wanted to say just the right thing. So I thought about it. And before I knew it, a week or 10 days had gone by. And I thought, this may be too late. What are you doing here? You got to give her an answer. So I worked on an answer, and then I got another letter, and then I realized I have to have an answer ready the day a letter like that comes in, because I was starting to get them, and I got to be able to get it out. So I wrote a kind of a form letter that was personal, in spite of the fact that it was a prepared letter. I could fill in certain things from the letter quickly that would make it personal, and I would include the number of a local suicide hotline. But the thing about being famous that really got me was, here, this is what being famous is. You send warm personal letters that are form letters to people who are suicidal. And it was a horrifying experience.
And if any of you received any of those letters, I don't want you to be offended by the fact that it was a form letter.
Yeah. And you know, please. It might have been bad that I sent them Dear Occupant. But I at the time that seemed okay.
I remember coming to you on this set, I don't know, after maybe the second year or third year that I was on the show. Maybe the second year. And I said, are you hearing the same? We would work 6 months out of the year, maybe 7 months out of the year, and then we'd have 5 months off because we were doing a half-hour show, and there was a period of the year that we were not working on that, so we could do other projects. And for whatever reason, I had traveled somewhere and come back, and I sat down with Alan on the first day and said, are you hearing what I'm hearing out there.
And or among the regular
from
people.
From the world, yeah, from the people. And I remember you saying, yeah. And we sat and talked about it for quite a while as to what the feeling was that people were investing something in this show and in us, those people who were represented in the show, way beyond anything, as Alan just said, way beyond anything that I had ever experienced before. And it gave me this sense, a deep feeling of a sense of responsibility, and I think it did for all of us, a sense that we owed it to whatever was happening out there as a result of this show and the people's reaction to it. We owed it to them to make sure that we did everything we could to keep the integrity of this show at its peak at all times, because as much fun as we were having doing it, it was meaningful to people in a way that I had not fully understood was
even possible.
I think
we all got a sense that we were doing something that was bigger than any one of us, mm-hmm. bigger than all of us put together. The synergy of the people who came together to do the show was making something that none of us was able to do without the others. And I think that made us pitch in a little harder. Mm-hmm. I don't think anybody tried to stand out in front of the others.
No, I think that's right. That's right. There was, as I've said it a couple times, the star of MASH was MASH.
Yeah. You know, and now we've talked a lot. This is very interesting. I think because the two of us are so glad to see each other and haven't really, we haven't told stories. Like when we get together for dinner, maybe once a year we manage to do that, mm-hmm. right? And we usually just kid each other. And we don't reminisce all that much. And I think tonight, for some reason, we got into the mood of reminiscing about MASH. The funny thing is, in your 300 and some page book, you talked about MASH for about 4 or 5 pages, I think. And I talked about it in my 240 page book about 5 or 10 pages. And the other things in our lives were so palpable to us that we wanted to explore. In Mike's case, I think your activism and your and also the personal journey you took in learning to be so honest with yourself, and in my case, trying to learn in the first book how to be spontaneous, and in the second book, trying to learn what the meaning of my life was, trying to figure out what it meant. Because as you probably have all heard of a couple of times this week, because I've been talking about it on television and stuff, that I almost died about 4 years ago, I was on a mountaintop in Chile doing the science program,
right.
and I was talking to astronomers, and I got this obstructed intestine, and a wonderful, brilliant surgeon who happened to be there in the middle of the night in this small town. this is kind of funny, I'll tell you. This isn't part of the theme of the evening. They took me down in this old ambulance from the top of the mountain that looked like a MASH ambulance. And it worked like one, too. Remember, we never could get them started? They couldn't get this ambulance started. And I'm lying in the back screaming in pain. This is the worst pain you can feel when your intestines get knotted up. And it was dying. My intestine was dying. And within a couple hours, I would be dead along with it. So I get down, and the guy examines me, Dr. Zepeda, and he said, now here's what's happened. He leans into my face because I'm a little, now I'm on morphine, which was very nice, by the way. You know, I just have a little wine and beer, but this was very nice. So he said, now here's what's happened. Some of your intestine has gone bad, and we have to cut out the bad part and sew the two good ends together. And I said, oh, you're going to do an end-to-end anastomosis. And he said, how do you know that? I said, oh, I did many of them on MASH. And that was the first operation that I learned about on MASH. And we understood, all of us understood the concept, but now this guy was going to do it. And he had watched MASH when he was in high school. So the two of us were coming to this evening from a fictional background. But boy, I was, you know, I wouldn't have cared if Mike was operating on me. I was in so much pain. I just wanted it to be over. I would have been, I mean, I people say you must have been scared. And did you trust being in another country? And no, I was so delighted. I was in the room with somebody who said, I know, I'm going to cut you open now.
Right.
And take that this. Bad thing out. I was just delighted.
Now, did as I recall, didn't he give you a choice, though?
He did. Oh, you're right. He did. See, Mike read the book, and I forgot it already.
He was just there.
Yes, I remember that in perfect detail. He said that he was very kind, this guy, very, very modest. He said, now, look, you know, we have all the equipment we need at this hospital, but if you would rather go to Santiago, where they have bigger hospitals, we could try to find a plane for you and fly you there. He said, however, our airport is fogged in. And if you wait for the fog to lift, you may not make it. Just picture being told that. Mm-hmm. You may not make it. I mean, and it took me a second through the fog of my own morphine to realize that you may not make it meant you're going to die. And I said, well, do it, fine, just do it.
Yeah.
And well, the end of the story is I lived.
And we're glad about that. I think there is something, I know this is not scientifically determinable, but I think there's something about the fact that given the remote nature of the place where you were, the extraordinary development, and the fact that this surgeon was in this relatively small Chilean village,
yes,
who had the capacity to not only understand what was happening with you, but to fix it. I think that's quite extraordinary.
Well, I thought it was very nice. I don't. Now, what's interesting is I don't think there was anything supernatural about it at all. However, and you know my dedication to scientific principles and ideas and everything, and how glad I was to have this experienced, dedicated, knowledgeable surgeon working on me. I found out later that he believes in angels.
Oh.
Yeah, and if he had mentioned that beforehand. No, I would.
You said, don't tell me that. I don't want to hear it. Go.
Just pick up the knife.
That's right.
Well, you know what? I have a feeling that we should take some questions because we don't want to keep everybody here too late. We can go out and have a couple of beers and
sure.
keep talking. Yes. Well, now wait till the microphone gets to you. Sorry. Thank you. And what will you do during the podcast? Cut this pause out?
First of all, I want to thank both of you, not only for your careers and the talent you've brought to all of us, but for your activism. And having grown up in the 60s, I always tell people one person can make a difference. And I thank you for doing that. And both of you, I'd love to hear both of you answer this. Did you come to it from a family that instilled that in you? Was it working on MASH? How did you come to taking on such important issues and really being involved?
Why don't you answer first?
Well, I think it's true. I'll answer for both of us. I think it's
no,
true
you
that
won't.
To this degree, I think it's true that we were both involved in certain issues before we came to MASH. In my case, it was not my family. I was raised in a family that was not given to political involvement, but. As a result of my own needs, I was a seeker and was exposed to a certain number of things. Unlike Alan, I have a sense that there is some sort of guiding force out there. And whatever the case, I was brought to certain understandings through the grace of God or good fortune or whatever it is that happens, and have been moved to understand what I believe to be my responsibilities as a citizen of the United States and as a citizen of the world, if you will. And that, for me, means being involved.
I don't know where I got interested in other people because I'm an actor. I I don't know. You know, I was always interested in the underdog, and I think that may have gone back to my childhood, the childhood experiences that I've lost in memory. But I hope I don't disappoint you with this. Although I considered myself an activist and called myself an activist for 10 or 15 years when I was younger. I'm no longer a political activist. In fact, I don't talk about politics in public. I'm a citizen and I'm concerned, and I have very strong opinions. But I don't march. I don't talk. I really devote myself to what I think I do best, which is to try to learn how to be a better actor and a better writer. And I wouldn't go in public. I mean, I worked, as I'm sure you know, I worked really hard to get the Equal Rights Amendment passed for 10 years. And whenever we weren't in front of the cameras on MASH, I was out lobbying state legislators trying to get it ratified, or I was making speeches, or I was writing articles. And I really worked hard on it because I believed in it. And even though it didn't get ratified, I think the culture, as a result of the efforts of all the people who worked on that campaign, raised the consciousness of the country, and people who took it for granted that it was the wrong thing to do to raise the status of women equal to men, now take it for granted that it's the right thing to do. The very same people, I hear them talking now. And however, it may have intensified after I came back to life on October 19th in Chile 4 years ago. I'm really very, very concerned about living my life as consciously as I can, and to do what I do best and have the feeling of satisfaction of spending my time as well as I can. And I am not a politician. I was an amateur at that. And I want to be as good as I can at what I know how to do. In fact, I was having some Chinese food before. We had some dumplings. I was having dumplings before around the corner, and in Chinatown. And my fortune cookie said, "You have a talent for all that is artistic, the Peking Noodle Company." And I think you're right. I think there is a higher power that is in Chinatown, actually. And somebody over at the Peking Noodle Company is guiding me toward art, which is where I really belong. And so I hope I don't disappoint you, that I have strong feelings about things. But I also think independently, and you know, Mike and I don't agree on some things, and I love him, and I love it, I love it that we think things through, and sometimes don't agree on the same thing, on everything, and I wish we could have a conversation like that throughout the country. I wish people, the one thing I will say that's political, is that I wish they would listen to one another, these people who have our lives in their hands, and not make decisions based on how long they can stay in power or how they can get into power.
See, he's not political at all.
Yes, anybody else? There's somebody up here. Okay, da-dum-da-dum-da-dum-da-dum-da-dum. I'm filling in for the podcast. Oh, well, we didn't get to you, sorry.
Thank you so much. I'm a writer myself, and I agree. I think MASH is probably the best written show ever on, in my view. The characters really spoke to sincerity, really deep feelings, and two questions in one, really. How did your characters change you personally? And what were your favorite episodes?
Oh.
Well, I think Mike became a much nicer person. Well, go ahead. You answer it.
I don't know that the character changed me personally. I fell in love with B.J. Honeycutt. I found him to be...
It's called autoeroticism.
Yes. I found him to be the kind of person I would want to have for a friend, and I always will have. It was, for me, one of the most important... Working on the show, having the good luck, good fortune to be B.J., was one of the most important personal experiences of my life, and certainly the most important personal career experience. As far as my favorite episode is concerned, I've always loved the show called The Interview, the black and white half-hour kind of You Are There episode that I thought it was a brilliant, brilliant show that really captured everything the show was about.
And that was the only show that we ever improvised. It was almost entirely improvised. I had been lobbying for improvising for two or three or four years, because I had started out in improvising as an actor, and I knew that if people would do that, they would. When you do that, stuff comes up that you can't make up. It's a spontaneity and a believability that's really powerful. And so, independent of my lobbying, Larry Gelbart and Gene Reynolds came up with their own idea for an improvised show, which was The Interview. And they asked us they gave us questions and on a piece of paper, and asked us to go off when we had free time during the shooting of another show and answer the questions in character into a tape recorder. So we would improvise these answers. Then Larry Gelbart took all of these transcripts and condensed them, punched them up with a couple of other jokes, and gave us back our improvisations in a shorter form that we then did on camera with Cleet Roberts, who was interviewing us. However, while the camera was turning, he would then ask us impromptu questions that we had never heard before, and we would answer them in character. And that was some of the most fun we ever had on the show.
It was fabulous.
Do you remember the show? Something came out of the way we worked that was really interesting. And we haven't told this story too many times, I don't think. Do you remember the story about the appendix?
Sure.
Yeah, well, sure. He says sure, like he remembers everything. you want to tell him? I've been talking a lot. You want to tell then?
I'll tell part of it. My part. The show, as was the case with many, if not all, most of the shows we did, the individual shows came out of research. Gene and Larry and Alan and some of the writers did an inordinate amount of research, going back, talking to people who'd been in Korea, nurses and doctors, and the patients, people who'd been patients, and then expanding it into Vietnam. And they got wonderful story ideas out of that. And one of them was about a gung-ho military officer who was so hot to make his medals and make his points and get the body count up that he was sending his troops into situations that should have not, we felt, certainly he should not have done. And we were getting the wounded as a result of it. And Hawkeye and BJ decided that when this guy came, he was this big, tough, arrogant SOB, and when he came to see his men who were chopped up in our post-op, we were going to slip him a Mickey, to take him for a drink, slip him a Mickey, excuse me, and tell him that he had appendicitis, take out his appendix, and thereby get him off the line for a while.
Now, this was based on a real event, wasn't it?
Was saving lives. And it came out of research. One of the doctors actually in the actual MASH had done that. And we read the script, and at the end of which we did every time before we did the
show. We read the script out loud at the table.
At the table. Reading the script, and at the end of it was one of the great things about MASH. The director would say, anybody have any questions or concerns? And I said, yeah, I have a question or a concern. BJ wouldn't do this. And everybody kind of stopped, and they said, "Well, but it came out of research. It was actually." I said, "No, I don't argue that it happened. I'm just saying that, as I understand the character of B.J. Honeycutt, he wouldn't cut into a healthy body and take the risk of damaging somebody." And Alan said, "Hawkeye would."
And that led to about a 45-minute or an hour-long discussion, argument that we had, I mean, with great feeling and great affection for each other, but we were very passionate about this, about whether or not, and the story was in danger of not happening that week because, you know, Mike said that BJ wouldn't do it. And after about an hour of this, I suddenly realized, and I think I was the one who realized this, that this, what we were doing at the table, arguing about this operation, was what these two doctors would have done. So I stayed late that night till about 1 a.m, I think, with the guys who wrote the show, and we tried to figure out a scene. And I was there partly to make sure that the points of view that we had both expressed would get condensed and put into the show. And I think it became one of the best scenes that we ever had in the show because it came out of such personal passion that we had.
I think that was part of the magic of the show, that people listened. They listened to our points of view about things. They were interested in our points of view. And they saw here was a better show than we had before.
So, anybody else about how great we were?
Yes, how great you are. I'm over here. Hello.
Where are you? Sorry. Thank you.
The surgeon in South America watched MASH as a child, as a young person. Is that why he went into surgery? And did he know that you were that actor when he operated on you?
Oh, he knew I was I was the guy he had watched on television. In fact, this gets back to the strangeness of celebrity. He was about to save my life. However, he took a longer time figuring out what was wrong with me than he would have if I weren't famous. And he told me this a year later, because all doctors would do this, because if you make a mistake on a famous person, that's the end of your career. You know, the next day it was all over South America and it was around the world that Hawkeye they thought I had my appendix out. They didn't know I had some of my intestine out. But he had to take longer. And I mean, he didn't risk my life by taking longer, but it wasn't the ordinary thing. However, when I found out he had watched MASH in high school, I just hoped he was going to say that's why he went into medicine, but he never said it. Somebody, yeah, with a couple of people here. Anybody? Thank you.
Thanks. First off, I love you guys.
I love a normal voice where there's, oh, I love you guys.
That's all. No, I actually was curious as far as, you know, you just seem to have this, and clearly hearing you talk now, you know, what all of us suspected, I'm sure, for, you know, watching you for so many years was true, that behind the scenes was such a camaraderie and such a beautiful interaction and everything. And I'm curious as to how things would change when you'd have a major cast shakeup, when it went from Wayne to Mike and from Larry to Charles and from McLean to Harry. Not that I ever watched the show. how it was both, you know, like just how, I mean, I guess it would be great to ask Mike just how weird that must be or how intimidating to come into this already existing group of people who with such a dynamic going on and how it affected, I mean, each of those three changes, how it affected and how the flow changed and what did you like better and worse and that sort of thing.
Yeah, what did you like better?
Well, Wayne was a better kisser.
You know, from my perspective, it was, I was given this opportunity to take, initially it was to have a meeting, and then it was to do a screen test, and then it was to get the part and become part of the cast of this show that I admired tremendously. And suddenly, when it had happened, two wonderful things happened. One was Alan called me immediately and said, let's have dinner together. And this was like the second thing I heard. One was you got the job, and the next was Alan wanted to have dinner with me. And I thought, afterward in particular, when I got over my being dumbfounded, I thought, what a generous and terrifically wonderful thing that was, because it allowed us to begin to get to know each other. It allowed me to have a better understanding of the company I was going into and the man with whom I was going to do most of the work. And it was the kind of generosity that I will say to embarrass him.
I'm not embarrassed at all.
The kind of generosity that is rarely seen in this business, and it moved me then, and it moves me today. So
I remember what we talked about, and it was the same thing that Wayne and I talked about when we had dinner. Almost the first day that we started to work on the show, and that was dedicating ourselves to make it as good as we could.
Absolutely,
and that's
right.
What we said, right?
Yep.
And that it's going to be hard work, and it doesn't matter how hard it is. All we want to do is make it as good as we can, and getting close together, finding out who the other guy was, and finding out how you could relate to that other person in every way possible. That was what we dedicated ourselves to, mm-hmm. and everything that the show could become. Because you know, when we started this show, and at any point along the way, because we had new generations of writers coming in, when it began, and at several times after that, it could have been a standard situation comedy, which we never thought it was. It was always a play, and it could have become a standard service comedy. The typical thing where it's just hijinks at the front and guys are playing jokes on the brass, but you might not ever see the pain not only of the wounded but the pain of the people serving the wounded, and all of a sudden we had a play about people caught in a crucible that was, and I think you talk about it in your book, Mike, about how it people could relate to it who had never been in the service. But were doing a job, I think you said, people had to do a job that they didn't like, didn't want to do, but they knew they had to do it.
And people who were, as a result of that feeling of having to fulfill this responsibility, were taken away from their loved ones. So I think on some level everybody has had that experience, and I think that was the key ingredient that so informed so many people's reactions.
The thing that made, to answer the other part of your question, the thing that made changing characters, changing actors and bringing them into the show, the thing that made that work was the really brave decision on the part of the producers, Burt Metcalf, Gene Reynolds, and Larry Gelbart, not to replace the characters with similar characters. They created a new kind of character who had a different dynamic relationship now with the other people, so that it was almost like starting off on a new series. And that happened, three times? And that was very brave and very creative of them, because they had to create something that had to compete with the memory of these wonderful and memorable characters that were leaving the show. So now they didn't just have to be good; they had to capture your attention the way the other ones had, and the other ones were hard to beat because they had already been there week after week. And that's one of the things about a series that we forget: you get to believe you know these people because you see them so often, and so you really had a hard time to come in. And it almost worked.
Yeah.
Somebody, I think I saw your hand go up. Can you wait? They're going to run down to you, I think, with a. Last question. Okay. Oh, it better be good.
Yeah.
Don't worry. Don't be nervous. I know you can do it. Okay. Are you listening to the Mets game or something?
Well, first of all, I want to admire both you guys. I saw Mike at the Valley City Jewish Community Center when he spoke a few months ago. And in your book, Mike, you mentioned that you t- talked to Reagan's daughter, who was not in sync with her father at the time. But I was wondering, in your travels in San Salvador and so forth regarding the Contra deal, did you ever get to speak to Elliot Abrams or Oliver North or any of those other right-wingers that were promoting the wars in South America?
No, they don't talk to me.
he says with a grin. Well, we hear that that's our last question for tonight. I on my part, want to thank you for coming, and you've been really fun to talk to. And do let me urge you to read Mike's book, Just Call Me Mike. It's a really, really interesting account of a person's trajectory through life, through all the things that make his life, his own life, meaningful.
Well, thank you, Alan, and I want to thank you as well. This has been wonderful. It's been wonderful for me to be able to spend more time with Alan, because I don't get to do that often enough. And I want to encourage you to read both of his books.
Thank you all for coming.
And I think if I may just add, I think there is a similarity in theme, because on some level we're both discussing the meaning attached to being here in this world.
That's nice. Good night, everybody. Thank you.
Aloud Audio is presented by the Library Foundation of Los Angeles and made possible through the generosity of the law firm Arendt Fox. Additional support is provided by the Ralph M. Parsons Foundation, City National Bank, KPMG, contributors to the Stay Home and Read a Book Ball, and Donna and Martin J. Wolfe. Media support provided by KCRW 89.9 FM, KUSC 91.5 FM, and KCET.